Benazir Bhutto, Daughter of the East, An Autobiography. Chapter 6, Reflections from Al-Murtaza, The Judicial Murder of My Father. Page 154, Paragraph 4. February 12, 1979, Sehala Police Camp. The authorities came in the morning to tell Mummy and me that we were being moved to a police training camp in Sehala, a few miles from my father's prison in Rawalpindi. We were taken to a remote building surrounded by barbed wire on the top of a barren hill. Nothing was provided for us. No blankets, no food, nothing. Ibrahim and Bashir, two of our household staff from Al-Murtaza, had to make the long trip back and forth every day with provisions. February 13, 1979, the lawyers finished writing their petition at 5 a.m. The morning it had to be submitted. The court granted my father's stay of execution while the petition was reviewed. On February 24, the court hearing began. Meanwhile, appeals for clemency flooded into Pakistan once more from heads of state around the world. All the politicians are asking to save a fellow politician, but not many non-politicians have asked me for clemency, Zia scoffed, describing the pleas from the heads of state as nothing more than trade union activity. I visited my father from Sehala at the beginning of March. I don't know how he kept going. He had refused all medical treatment since the death sentence had been upheld and had stopped taking any medication. He had also stopped eating, not only because of the pain in his gums and teeth, but as a protest against his treatment. He was being kept locked in his cell now, unable to use the commode the prison officials had set up for him in another cell. As usual, I was looking forward very much to seeing him, even more so that day because I had a surprise for him. Before my mother's latest arrest, she had gone to Karachi and brought back my father's dog, Happy, to keep me company in detention. I loved Happy. We all loved Happy, a fluffy wild white mongrel my sister had given to my father. "Now you be quiet," I whispered to Happy when I arrived at Rawalpindi Central Jail with him under my coat. At the search area at the first barrier, I found, to my great luck, that the jail superintendent wasn't there, nor was Colonel Rafi, the head of the army contingent posted inside the jail, who always stood around watching our every move. Happy and I moved on to the second barrier. Luckily, the policewoman searching me didn't object. "We don't have orders to search for a dog," one of them said sympathetically. I stepped inside the final prison enclosure. "Go and find him," I said to Happy, letting him loose. Happy put his nose to the ground and dashed from cell to cell. I heard him yapping with excitement when he found my very surprised father. "How much more loyal dogs are than men," my father said when I caught up the two of them. The authorities were furious when they found out about the dog. Happy was never allowed to visit my father again, but at least I had been able to give my father that one moment, a reminder of life when we were a normal family, a mother, father, and four children living under one roof with dogs and cats in the garden. During the first weeks of March, our lawyers flooded the court with more grounds for review. They were exhausted by the enormity of their burden. When Mummy and I tuned into the BBC Evening News at Sehala at the beginning of March, we heard that Ghulam Ali Memon, a member of my father's defense team and one of Pakistan's most highly respected lawyers, had died at his desk at Flashman's of a heart attack. "Allah ya Allah," he had reportedly said in the midst of dictating what was to be his final legal attack against the majority decision of the Supreme Court. Another victim was claimed. We turned off the radio. What could we say? On March 23rd, the anniversary of the day Pakistan's founder, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, called for the establishment of an independent Muslim state, Zia announced that he would hold elections in the autumn. The next day, the Supreme Court announced its decision. Though my father's petition was dismissed, the court unanimously recommended that the sentence be commuted to life. Once again, hope surged. The decision now rested solely with Zia. 7 days, there were 7 days for somebody, anybody, to persuade Zia not to send my father to his death, and Zia had every reason to spare him. A split decision, especially such a close one of 4-3, like my father's, had never resulted in the death sentence in Pakistan. No executive government in judicial history had refused to accept the unanimous recommendation of the highest court in the country to commute the death sentence, and no one in the history of the subcontinent had ever been put to death for conspiracy to murder. There was pressure on Zia too, from abroad. Messages were pouring in again from foreign heads of state. Prime Minister Callaghan of Great Britain appealed to Zia for mercy for the third time. Saudi Arabia, the seat of fundamentalist Islam, appealed again. Even President Carter joined in and appealed this time. But there was no reply from Zia. The minutes ticked by towards my father's fate. No date of execution was announced, giving the people false hope. No one wanted to accept what my father had always known, preferring to cling to the unanimous recommendation of the court and Zia's promises to Muslim governments to commute the sentence to life. A plea from my father or his immediate family, Zia had also let it be known, would give him a way to save face and commute the sentence. But my father, who had accepted the inevitability of his death long before, continued to refuse. An innocent man does not appeal for mercy for a crime he did not commit. My father insisted, forbidding us to appeal as well. His older sister, one of my aunts in Hyderabad, went ahead and appealed anyway, delivering her petition at the gate to Zia's house an hour before the deadline was to expire. But there was still no reply from Zia. The signs were increasingly ominous. In Rawalpindi Central Jail, what pitiful pieces of furniture there were in my father's cell were taken away, including his bed. He was left to sleep on the floor on his roll of bedding. They even took away his razor, leaving my usually cleanly shaven father with the stubble of grey beard on his face. He was ill and very weak. In Sehala, I was served with another detention order, restricting me for another 15 days on the grounds that I would resort to further agitational politics as a final bid to secure the release of my father, posing a serious threat to peace and tranquility and to the efficient conduct of martial law. Nobody knew what was going to happen. Would Zia actually go ahead and hang my father in spite of world condemnation and the recommendations of the court? If so, when? The answer seemed tragically clear on April 3, when my mother and I were taken to our last meeting. Yasmin, Yasmin, they're going to kill him tonight. Amina, you here too? It's tonight, tonight. The lawyers drew up another review petition. Amina flew to Karachi, where she and one of my father's lawyers, Mr. Hafiz Lakho, tried to submit it to the court. The registrar refused to accept it. Give the petition to the judges, the registrar told them, but the judges wouldn't accept it either. One judge even slipped out of the back door of the courthouse to avoid them. Amina and Mr. Lakho went to the senior judge's private house and pleaded at the gate. The judge refused to see them. Broken-hearted, Amna flew back to Islamabad. April 3, 1979. Tick, tick. Law forces are cordoning off our family graveyard, cutting off all the roads to Garhi Khudabaksh. Tick, tick. Amna goes directly to the Niazi's house from the airport, not wanting to be alone. Tick, tick. It's tonight, Dr. Niazi is saying quietly into the phone over and over again, as Yasmin and Amina lie silent and wide awake in the darkened house. Tick, tick. An army truck pulls away quickly from Rawalpindi Central Jail in the early morning. A short time later, Yasmin hears a small plane fly across Islamabad. She convinces herself that it belongs to one of the Arab leaders who has got into the prison and is spiriting my father away to safety. But the plane she hears is taking my father's body home to Larkana.